Chapter 51. Massard's chief aide, Felix Varenne, stepped into his boss's office. A call from Ismail Yerli at Kazim's headquarters. Massard nodded and picked up the phone.
Yes, Ismail, I hope this is good news.
I regret to tell you, Mr. Massard, the news is anything but good.
Did Kazim catch the UN combat unit?
No, he has yet to find them. Their plane was destroyed, as we thought, but they vanished in the desert.
Why can't his patrols follow their tracks? Massard demanded angrily.
The desert wind has blown sand over them, Yerli answered calmly. All trace of their trail has been obliterated.
What is the situation at the mine?
The prisoners have rioted, killed the guards, and destroyed the equipment and ravaged the offices. Your engineers are dead, too. It will take 6 months to put the mine back in full operation.
But what of O'Banion?
Disappeared. No sign of his body. My men did find his sadistic overseer, however.
The American, he called Melika.
The prisoners mutilated her body with a vengeance almost beyond recognition.
The raiders must have taken O'Banion as informant against us, suggested Massard.
Too soon to tell, Yerli replied. Kazim's officers have just begun interrogating the prisoners. Another bit of news I can pass along that won't sit well with you is that the Americans, Pitt and Giordino, were recognized by one surviving guard. They somehow fled the mines over a week ago, crossed into Algeria, and returned with the UN raiders.
Massard was thunderstruck.
Good God, that means they reached Algiers and made outside contact.
My thoughts also.
Why weren't we informed by O'Banion they had escaped?
Fear of how you and Kazim would react, obviously.
How they traveled over 400 kilometers of desert without food and water is a mystery.
If they exposed our operation of the mine with captive labor to their superiors in Washington, they must have also revealed the secret of Fort Fourreau.
They have no documented proof, Yerli reminded him.
Two foreigners who illegally crossed sovereign borders and committed criminal acts against the Malian government will not be taken seriously in any international court of law.
Except that my project will be besieged with news correspondents and world environmental investigators.
Not to worry. I will advise Kazim to close the borders to all outsiders and have them expelled if they do.
You're forgetting, said Massard, trying to remain calm, the French engineers and scientists I contracted to build the project and threw into Tabeza. Once they reach safety, they will spread the word of their abduction and imprisonment. Even more damaging, they will expose our illegal waste dumping operation. Massard Enterprises will be attacked on all fronts, and I will face criminal charges in every country I have an office or project.
None will live to give evidence, Yerli said, as if it was a foregone conclusion.
What is the next step? Massard asked.
Kazim's aerial reconnaissance and motor patrols can find no indication of their crossing into Algeria. That means they're still in Mali, staying undercover and awaiting rescue.
Which Kazim's forces will stop?
Of course.
Could they have headed west for Mauritania?
Yerli shook his head to himself.
Not with over 1,000 kilometers between them and the first village with water. Also, they couldn't possibly have carried enough fuel for that distance.
They must be stopped, Ismail, said Massard, without concealing a note of desperation. They must be exterminated.
And they shall be, Yerli promised. I vow to you they will not get out of Mali. Every last one of them will be hunted down. They may fool Kazim, but they won't fool me.
El-Hajj Ali sat in the sand under the shade of his camel and waited for a train to pass by. He had walked and ridden over 200 kilometers from his village of Arouane to see the wonder of a railroad, described to him by a passing Britisher who was leading a group of tourists across the desert. Just past his 14th birthday, Ali's father had given him permission to take one of the family's two camels, a superb white animal, and travel north to the shining rails and witness the great steel monster with his own eyes. Though he had seen automobiles and distant aircraft in the sky, other wonders, such as cameras, radios, and television sets, were a mystery to him. But to actually see and perhaps touch a locomotive would make him the envy of every boy and girl in his village. He drank tea and sucked on boiled sweets as he waited. After 3 hours and no sign of an approaching train, he mounted his camel and set off along the tracks toward the Fort Fourreau project, so he could tell his family about the immense buildings that rose out of the desert. As he passed the long-abandoned foreign legion fort, surrounded by high walls, isolated and lonely, he turned off the rails and approached the gate out of curiosity. The big, sun-bleached doors were shut tight. He jumped from his camel and led it around the fort's walls, looking for another opening to gain entrance inside. But finding only solid mud and stone, he gave up and walked back toward the railroad. He looked to the west, intrigued with the way the silver rails strung out far into the distance and curled under the heat waves rising from the sun-baked sands. His eye caught something as he stood on the ties and stared. A speck appeared and floated through the heat waves. It enlarged and came toward him. The great steel monster, he thought with excitement. But as the object drew closer, he could see it was too small for a locomotive. Then he discerned two men riding on it as if it was an open automobile driving on the rails. Ali moved off the track bed and stood next to his camel as the motor cart carrying two section hands who were inspecting the track rolled to a stop in front of him. One was a white foreigner. The other, a dark-skinned Moor, greeted him. "Salam alaikum." "Alaikum el salam," Ali replied. "Where do you come from, boy?" asked the Moor in the Berber language of the Tuareg. "From Marouane to see the steel monster." "You've come a long way." "The trip was easy," Ali boasted. "You have a fine camel." "My father loaned me his best." The Moor looked at a gold wristwatch. "You don't have long to wait. The train from Mauritania is due in about 45 minutes. "Thank you. I will wait," said Ali. "See anything interesting inside the old fort?" Ali shook his head. "I could not enter. The gates are locked." The two section men exchanged quizzical glances and conversed in French for a few moments. Then the Moor asked, "Are you certain? The fort is always open. That is where we keep ties and equipment to repair the track bed." "I do not lie. See for yourself." The Moor stepped down from the motor cart and walked up to the front of the fort. He returned a few minutes later and spoke to the white man in French. "The boy is right. The doors to the main gate are locked from within." The face of the French track surveyor turned serious. "We must continue into the waste project and report this." The Moor nodded and climbed back on the motor cart. He threw Ali a wave. "Do not stand too close to the tracks when the train comes, and keep a tight grip on your camel." The engine's exhaust popped, and the motor cart rolled down the rails in the direction of the hazardous waste project, leaving Ali staring after it while his camel gazed stoically at the horizon and spit on the track. Colonel Marcel Levant realized he could not prevent the nomad boy and the railroad section hand from inspecting the exterior of the fort. Silently, menacingly, a dozen unseen machine guns had been trained on the curious intruders. They could have easily been shot and dragged into the fort, but Levant did not have the stomach for killing innocent civilians, so they were spared. "What do you think?" Pembroke Smythe asked as the motor cart sped down the track toward the waste site's security station. Levant studied the boy and his camel, his eyes squinting like those of a sniper. They were still resting beside the tracks, waiting for the next passing train. "If those two on the cart tell Massard's security guards the fort is sealed up, we can expect an armed patrol to investigate." Pembroke Smythe checked the time. "A good 7 hours before dark. Let's hope they're slow in responding." "Any late word from General Bach?" asked Levant. "We've lost contact. The radio was knocked about during the journey from Tabeza, and the circuitry became damaged. We can no longer transmit, and reception is quite weak. The General's last message came through too garbled to decode properly. The best the operator could make of it was something about an American Special Operation Force team that was going to hook up with us in Mauritania." Levant stared incredulously at Pembroke Smythe. "The Americans are coming, but only as far as Mauritania? Good God, that's over 300 kilometers from here. What in hell good will they do us in Mauritania if we're attacked before we can escape over the border?" "The message was unclear, sir," Pembroke Smythe shrugged helplessly. "Our radio operator did his best. Perhaps he misunderstood." "Can he somehow rig the radio to our combat communications gear?" Pembroke Smythe shook his head. "He already thought of that angle. The systems are not compatible." "We don't even know if Admiral Sandecker deciphered Pitt's code correctly," Levant said wearily.
For all Buck knows, we may be wandering around the desert in circles or fleeing for Algeria. I like to think positive, sir.
Levant sank down heavily and leaned against a parapet. No chance of making a run for it. Not nearly enough fuel. Getting caught in the open by the Malians is almost a certainty. No contact with the outside world. I'm afraid many of us are going to die in this rat hole, Pembroke Smythe.
Look on the bright side, Colonel. Perhaps the Americans will come charging in here like General Custer's 7th Cavalry.
Oh, God, Levant moaned despairingly. Why did you have to go and mention him?
Giordino lay stretched out on his back under a personnel carrier, removing a chassis spring, when he saw Pitt's boots and legs step into his limited view.
Where have you been? He grunted while twisting a nut from a shackle bolt.
Tending to the weak and infirm, answered Pitt cheerfully.
Then tend to the framework of your oddball whatchacallit. You can use the beams from the ceilings in the officers' quarters. They're dry but sound.
You've been busy.
A pity you can't say the same, Giordino said complainingly. You'd better start figuring out how you're going to attach it all together.
Pitt lowered a small wooden keg to the ground in Giordino's line of sight.
Problem solved. I found half a keg of spikes in the mess hall.
The mess hall?
Exposed in a storeroom in the mess hall, Pitt corrected himself.
Giordino pushed himself from under the vehicle and examined Pitt, his eyes traveling from the unlaced boots to the half-opened combat suit to the disheveled hair. When he finally spoke, it was in a voice heavy with sarcasm.
I bet that keg wasn't the only thing you exposed in the storeroom.